thought about what might be a good lesson for you today. I'm going to bring you a lesson that I've brought to you before, but I thought it would be one worth repeating, and maybe it would be timely given the season that we are in, which tends to have maybe the table is a little bit more lavishly set than it would be normally. I recently preached to you from Ecclesiastes 10 and brought to you a sermon on the topic of feasting for strength. And we had used that as an opportunity to think about what that means. Feasting for strength, not instead of feasting for drunkenness. We took that as an opportunity to think about how we use the good things that God has given us. And so I thought I would bring to you a lesson today that I've brought to you before on table manners. So if you would like to look with me at the book of Proverbs, and we're going to be in Proverbs chapter 23, and we're going to be looking at the first five verses of chapter 23. It's a proverb on table manners, and it's a proverb on the proper placement of the knife. Normally, when you think of table manners or table etiquette, you might be thinking, okay, well, the fork goes on this side of the plate and the knife goes on that side of the plate. And in my house, we use the small forks when all the big forks are in the dishwasher. But this lesson from Proverbs isn't going to be about those kinds of things. But it will be about wise, very wise table manners. But before we look at that proverb, let's remember that the beginning of the book of Proverbs tells us how to interpret the Proverbs. All right? We want to make sure we don't make a mistake of misinterpreting the proverb or really missing entirely the meaning of it. So let's remember how the book of Proverbs begins, and I'll read this to you. It says, "The Proverbs of Solomon, the son of David, king of Israel." And here's the purpose statement of the book. Here's why we are given these proverbs. "To know wisdom and instruction, to perceive the words of understanding, to receive the instruction of wisdom, justice, judgment, and equity, to give prudence to the simple, to the young man, knowledge and discretion. A wise man will hear and increase learning, and a man of understanding will attain wise counsel. To understand a proverb and an enigma, the words of the wise and their riddles." And then it says, "The fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge, but fools despise wisdom and instruction." Therefore, the beginning, an ongoing, governing, controlling principle to gain wisdom, to grow in wisdom, to gain understanding, to grow in understanding, to gain discretion, to gain discernment, and to grow in those things. The beginning and the ongoing controlling foundation that we rest upon is the fear of the Lord. Right? The reverential, worshiping, repenting, believing, humble submission to the God of covenant. That is the fear of the Lord. Right? That is the beginning of wisdom. That's the beginning of understanding. That's the controlling, governing principle of what it means to be wise and what it means to know and what it means to understand. All right? So when we puzzle over the Proverbs and when we contemplate them and when we begin to try to unravel these little riddles, when we try to understand the difficult sayings of the wise, we are always doing so while resting upon the gospel foundation. The book of Proverbs is not simply a collection of sayings to help you find success in life, but instead is a book that will deal with your heart. It's a book that will bring diagnosis to illnesses in your soul. The book of Proverbs speaks not just to life, but it speaks to covenant life. It speaks to covenant. This is a covenant. This is a proverb at the beginning of chapter 23 about life lived before the face of God. And think about the book of Proverbs in that way. It is a book of a collection of the sayings of the wise, which will give you instruction on life in the home before the face of God. Life as a parent before the face of God. Life as a child before the face of God. Life as an employer. Life as an employee before the face of God. Life as a church member before the face of God. The beginning of the book of Proverbs tells us then how we approach these sayings and how we begin to unravel them and how we're to properly interpret them. Right. So, Proverbs 23. These verses describe a table, and they describe that there's something very dangerous at that table. Very dangerous, and you need to be on guard against it. And the proverb will show you the safe course of action. It doesn't just leave you hanging, but it shows you how to be wise. Let's look at it. Here's something of a riddle. Something that might be difficult at first to understand, but we'll take it piece by piece. When you sit down to eat with a ruler, consider carefully what is before you. And put a knife to your throat if you are a man given to appetite. Do not desire his delicacies, for they are deceptive food. Do not overwork to be rich. Because of your own understanding, cease. Will you set your eyes on that which is not? For riches certainly make themselves wings. They fly away like an eagle toward heaven. Well, this is an invitation. So let's sit down at the table. And here is the table of a ruler. That means he's a man of great authority. That means he's a man of some success and he's a man of great influence. His resume is impressive with prestige and accomplishments and well-earned respect. He's a man with dominion over land and people. He rules and he enjoys the privileges that ruling pays for, and he's invited you over for dinner. And you arrive at his house, and standing outside his house, you recognize this man has been successful. And he welcomes you into his house, and just there in the foyer of the house, you recognize this man is wealthy. He has enjoyed great success. He has a lot of very nice things. And even without really trying very hard, you notice that you begin to do a mental comparison. You can hardly help doing it, right? You're in his house, but you're thinking about your house. And you're looking at his stuff, and you're thinking about yours. And you begin to think, wow, that looks nice. That looks way nicer than what I have. That looks expensive. That looks like something way more expensive than what I have in my house. That must be better than what I have. How happy this man must be to have this house. How happy this man and how satisfied he must be to have such nice things. This ruler has invited you to his house to eat at his table. So you make your way to the table, and the meal is served, and the table is filled with the best tasting food. It's filled with the finest food that money can buy. When you sit down to eat with a ruler, don't just start stuffing your face. Notice what the proverb says. When you sit down to eat with a ruler, consider. It's the same word that I read to you from the beginning of the book of Proverbs where it said perceive, to perceive. To perceive the words of understanding. The proverb here says, before you start eating, be perceptive. Before you start eating, you need to observe with understanding. Before you just start stuffing your face, observe what's in front of you with discernment. Before you start eating, rightly judge, rightly evaluate what is placed before you. Stop and think about what's happening before you start eating. So the proverb begins. When you sit down, consider. There's a potential that you could be harmed. There's reason for you to be suspicious. Consider. Look with wisdom. Now, how could you be harmed? Well, there's something deceptive about the food. You hear the Proverbs sound the alarm and tell you that that which has been set in front of you is deceptive. Now, what's your first reaction to that? You sit down at the table, there's something deceptive about the food. Your first reaction might be to cast a suspicious eye on your wealthy host. What's he trying to do to me? I mean, the food's deceptive. That might be your first response, to cast a suspicious eye on the host. But you notice the proverb does not tell you to do that. Your first reaction might be to wonder, what sin is lurking in the heart of the host which has put you into this potentially dangerous situation? But the proverb does not tell you to do that. Your first reaction may be to defend yourself. And in order to do that, you grab that properly placed knife and you hold it out in front of you to keep that evil host from harming you, except that the proverb does not tell you to hold out your knife in self-defense, at least not against the host. Consider carefully what is before you, says the proverb. Wisely discern, perceive the potential danger, and grab that knife and have it at the ready. Only you must defend yourself by holding the knife to yourself, to your own throat. That same throat that was just about to taste all of those rich delicacies. But there's a condition here. You don't have to grab the knife, notice in the proverb. You don't have to grab the knife unless you have an appetite problem. If you don't have an appetite problem, then you don't have to grab the knife and hold it to yourself. But if you have an appetite problem, then you need to hold the knife to your own throat. So here's the alarm. Here's the warning. It's this. The strange saying says something like this. Be on guard against the deceptiveness of those provisions, especially if you have the tendency for falling for a certain deception. And take the necessary measures to slay the desire to believe the lie that you could be believing at that point. Now, what does this strange saying mean? Yes, there is some trickery going on. There is an illusion going on, but it's not intended by the host. There is an illusion that your own heart wants to believe when you look at the host's savory food. There's an illusion that your heart wants to believe when you look at his abundant and wealthy provisions. Your own heart wants to believe the lie that what is set before you and all these things that you can see and feel and taste, that those are the things that will truly and lastingly satisfy you. That's the lie. That's the deception. You'll see that here in a minute. The host isn't trying to lie to you by giving you fake food, making it look like something that it isn't. The food itself is just food. The root of the trickery is in your own heart. The food itself doesn't say anything, but if you are a person given or with this strong tendency to set your heart on those things, then it's your heart that's lying to you about what that food can really give you. If you are prone to that, the proverb says, stop and consider what's in front of you. Don't just start stuffing your face. You've got to consider whether or not your heart is lying to you at this moment. There's a deceptiveness or there's a deception that could be going on. Stop and judge rightly. What's the lie that your heart wants to believe? Well, to look at the food, to look at the table, to look at the house, whatever, to look at all of these things and to say, that's real life. The lie is that that's the good life. This is lasting life, but it's a lie. It's deceptive. The lie is this, that you can find true and lasting satisfaction with indulgence of the flesh. Have you ever tested this? You have. We all have. You've tested it. This test is described in Ecclesiastes chapter 2. Let me just read some portions here to remind you, because the preacher conducted an experiment. Right? The lie is that you can find lasting satisfaction, permanent happiness, with these provisions. preacher decided he was going to put that to the test. He was going to conduct an experiment, see if the lie really was a lie. I said in my heart, "Come now, I will test you with mirth. Therefore, enjoy pleasure." But surely this also was vanity. I said, "Of laughter, madness. And of mirth, what does it accomplish?" I searched into my heart how to gratify my flesh with wine while guiding my heart with wisdom, and how to lay hold on folly till I might see what was good for the sons of men to do under heaven all the days of their lives. I made my works great. I built myself houses. I planted myself vineyards. I made myself gardens and orchards, and I planted all kinds of fruit trees in them. I made myself water pools from which to water the growing trees of the grove. I acquired male and female servants and had servants born in my house. Yes, I had greater possessions of herds and flocks than all who were in Jerusalem before me. I also gathered for myself silver and gold and the special treasures of kings and of the provinces. I acquired male and female singers, the delights of the sons of men, and musical instruments of all kinds, so that I became great and excelled more than all who were before me in Jerusalem. Also, my wisdom remained with me. Whatever my eyes desired, I did not keep from them. I did not withhold my heart from any pleasure, for my heart rejoiced in all my labor, and this was my reward from all my labor. And then he comes to this conclusion. He says, "Then I looked on all the works that my hands had done and on the labor in which I had toiled, and indeed all was what?" It's all vanity, he says. It was all vanity. It was all, he says, like grasping for the wind. He says, there was no profit under the sun. In the end, what did he have? Gardens, houses, vineyards, everything that a man, that a wealthy man could buy with the greatest of wealth. But he realizes in the end, what is he left with? Nothing. How much of that stuff lasts forever? He goes on in that very same chapter to make the point that the reason that this is so is that the same event happens to all. There's an event, and it's the same event, and it happens to the wise man just as much as it happens to the fool. It happens to the fool just as much as it happens to the wise. Do you remember what that one event is? They die. As a wise man dies, so the fool dies. They both die. So whether the man has a lavish table or whether the man has a very modest table, they both die. And that which they had flies away, or they fly away from it, and it belongs to somebody else. So here's the illusion. At the end of it all, I'll have something more than just an empty hand. I'll have something more than smoke and ashes. I'll be the exception to the rule. That's the illusion. That's the lie. That's the deception. But what does the experiment in Ecclesiastes 2, what does it reveal? It reveals that it is, in fact, a lie. Yes, there's happiness. Yes, there's enjoyment to be had in the things of life. But if that happiness is only in the things of this life, and if that satisfaction rises no higher in your heart than the food on the plate, that satisfaction will pass. That's the truth. The lie says, "Oh, no, 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 you can have this forever. This is life. This is the good life. This is the lasting life." But it's a lie. The preacher put it to the test, and in the end he says, it's true. It's a lie. It really is a lie. So when you have opportunity to enjoy the things of this life, the proverb here in chapter 23, it says, "Be careful, be attentive to what you're setting your hopes on." If you are placed in a situation where it's the especially nice provisions of this life, then be especially careful with what is the natural tendency in the human heart, which is to take the creature and to put it in the place of God, to worship and trust the provision rather than the provider. Consider, says the proverb, be on guard. Here's the lie, that if you work the ground just a little harder than the next man, then you can outrun the dust. The preacher put that to the test. He says, it's a lie. Don't believe it. You won't be the exception. The lie says that you can somehow avoid the end and its consequences. But dust is very patient. The grave has no anxiety. You can give yourself to a very busy pursuit of the treasures of this world. You can try to build a wall in between you and the inevitable end, but the end is inevitable and unavoidable. The grave knows that it has an appointment with you, and it doesn't get anxious about all the things you're collecting. And try as you might, you can't get out of this. Yes, says the preacher of Ecclesiastes 2, yes, go ahead and try it. Fill your belly, fill your vision, fill your devotion with food or other kinds of earthly provisions. Yes, stick your face fully into the plate of the delicacies of this life, but just remember that death is still there, tapping you on the shoulder, very patiently waiting for that appointment to be fulfilled. And one of the conclusions of the experiment in Ecclesiastes 2 was the ultimate futility of his labor to stockpile forever the temporary. Notice back here in chapter 23 that our proverb delivers you to the very same conclusion. Do you see it there? It's the very same conclusion as Ecclesiastes 2. Do not overwork to be rich. Because of your own understanding, cease. Will you set your eyes on that which is not? For riches certainly make themselves wings. They fly away like an eagle toward heaven. There's a playful use of imagery here. Literally in the text, it says, will your eyes fly upon that which is not? Will your eyes fly down to grab that which is an illusion? Will your heart be like a bird, circling and spying and swooping down upon that which will only pass with the using and leave you empty again? Will you set your heart upon and will you set your highest hopes for lasting well-being upon the same things that the humble moth and rust can take away from you? Well, then understand the warning. That which you might be tempted to fly to and to swoop down upon for lasting happiness will itself inevitably sprout its own wings and fly away. That's what the preacher of Ecclesiastes 2 discovered. All the houses, all the orchards, all the silver, all the gold, all of it was going to eventually sprout its own wings and fly away. So the proverb here says, consider. Consider if you are someone given to appetite. Because of your own understanding, because of wise perception, cease from filling your vision with the illusion that that stuff won't eventually fly away. So let's pay attention to our appetite here for a moment. We have to use the things of this world, don't we? We have to sit down and eat. But the root of the problem is not in the food. We can't measure sin with a definite number of calories or carbs. We can't say, well, you know, lower number, godly, higher number. We can't do that kind of thing. The root of this problem is not in the food, it's in our own heart. The issue is not that the poor provisions are godly and rich provisions are ungodly. All provisions are from the Lord. The problem lies within our own hearts. It lies within our thinking and perceiving, which are radically affected by sin. And so the proverb calls the alarm for it calls for our attentiveness to our weaknesses as we sit down to take in the food or as we take in any other necessary provision. Maybe it's an essential provision. Maybe it's an optional provision. The proverb is calling us to look upon these things with wisdom, lest we begin to believe the lie, which can be so easy to believe. The proverb is calling you to be attentive to your weaknesses at all times, but especially when you are in the presence of something where you might be more prone to believe the lie. And what that situation is for you, it might be different than what that situation is for me. Those situations where there may be temptations, it's calling you to be, it's calling you to pursue an ongoing and humble self-evaluation of the kind of temptations that tend to be successful against you. Now, what those are for you may be different than what they are for me, but we must be attentive. We must be thinking about these things. All sin is a danger to you, but some sins may be a greater temptation for you than others. This proverb is calling you to be especially attentive to your tendency to idolatry, to take some nice thing in creation and to use it in an idolatrous way. Proverb doesn't go into a whole list of things. That's your work. That's what you have to do at this point. Take this warning and apply it to the various situations that you are in or that you face. It may not be a table lavishly set with food. That may not be a temptation at all for you. So what is your appetite? Where do your appetites lay? What are those things in creation where it is especially tempting for you to, for the devotion of your heart to spread its wings and to swoop down upon it and to take it up as if it is the thing that will give you lasting happiness and lasting satisfaction, lasting safety? What is that for you? You have to be attentive to those things. Consider, says the proverb. So you need to study your own weaknesses. You're called to perceive if you're given to appetite. You're called here to understand if you struggle with corruption eruptions when it comes to certain provisions. You don't ever want to go to sleep in the presence of enemies. You don't want to get lazy, because that's when you get hurt. When you get careless is when you get hurt. That's when you can be harmed. Be aware of what tends to try and ambush you, remembering that the root of sin is not in the substance, but it's within your own heart. A word about harshness. You notice the proverb here says something quite harsh. It's quite shocking, isn't it? If you are given, or if you have a sinful tendency to use a thing sinfully, then take whatever measures are necessary to go to war against that corruption. That's what the proverb means. Hold a knife to my own throat. Oh, I can't believe I read that in the Bible. But really, it's really the same principle that Jesus himself says in Matthew 5 when he says, if your right eye causes you to sin, do what? Pluck it out and cast it from you. For it is more profitable for you that one of your members perish than for your whole body to be cast into hell. And if your right hand causes you to sin, cut it off and cast it from you, for it is more profitable for you that one of your members perish than for your whole body to be cast in hell. If you are a man given to appetite, if you are someone who is tempted to let the devotions of your heart fly upon something that's just temporary, the devotion of your heart, the vision of your eyes, if you're tempted for these things to swoop down upon things in an idolatrous way, looking for lasting happiness and lasting safety in those things, it would be better for you to have a knife to your throat than for you to be indulging your throat with this idolatry. That's the idea. We have to take the proper measures to defend ourselves. We have to be aware of these situations where we are especially tempted to believe the lie, to believe the illusion, and we need to do what it takes to go to war against that. And Matthew Henry says something that may be helpful to you. You're thinking, well, how do I do that? How do I... Because this sounds hard, right? This is going to war against these things that are so tempting, going to war against this tendency within my own heart to believe the lie. Matthew Henry says, to live a life of mortification, putting to death these things, to live a life of self-denial, to keep a constant watch over our own hearts, and to suppress the first rising of lust and corruption there, to avoid the occasions of sin, to resist the beginnings of it. He goes on to say this. How do we do this? He suggests this. We do this by seeking unto God for His grace and depending upon that grace daily. So Matthew Henry takes us and he delivers us back upon the faithfulness of the Lord, so that we pray to Him for His help and we seek Him for His grace, especially in those moments. We seek unto Him for His grace. We depend upon that grace, Matthew Henry says, daily. So there's this attentiveness that I think Proverbs 23 is getting at. Watch, be on guard, consider. And that really needs to be a constant considering, a constant daily watch. Let me leave you with a final word then, a final piece of advice. And this is the instruction that I gave you when I preached to you from Ecclesiastes 10 on feasting for strength instead of feasting for drunkenness. And it's the advice that comes to us from Psalm 104. Let me read a portion of that to you again. Psalm 104, beginning at verse 10, says, He, speaking of the Lord, He sends the springs into the valleys. They flow among the hills. They give drink to every beast of the field. The wild donkeys quench their thirst. By them the birds of the heavens have their home. They sing among the branches. He waters the hills from His upper chambers. The earth is satisfied with the fruit of Your works. He causes the grass to grow for the cattle and the vegetation for the service or for the cultivation of man, that he may bring forth food from the earth and wine that makes glad the heart of man, oil to make his face shine, and bread which strengthens man's heart. God has created all that there is, and God provides for His creation. Observe the donkey, observe the birds, observe the wild beast. There they have what they need, all provided for according to the will of God. And God provides vegetation, and He provides it that we would cultivate it, that we would pull our food out of the ground. And what's the point of all of this? What's the point of this cultivation? It's more than just bringing forth food. There's something that we get to have that the animals don't get to have as we pull our food from the ground and as we enjoy our food. The psalm puts us in a different category than the animals. The wild beasts and the donkeys and the birds, they have their physical needs provided for. And while it is true that God gives us the means to make food for our physical needs, He goes beyond that for us. There's something which God provides for us which He does not provide for the beasts and the donkeys and the birds. And you know what that is? Gladness. You know what that is? It's delight. I know your dog wags his tail when you put a bowl of food in front of him. But it is not gladness in his heart to the Lord for the Lord's goodness to him. The dog doesn't get to enjoy that. The dog doesn't know that. But we do. Gladness, delight, consolation, inner comfort. And what does God use in part to give us those gifts? Our food and drink. Food for our cultivation. And what kind of an effect does this food have upon us? It gladdens our heart. It makes our face shine, which is about your countenance, right? There's this smile of comfort and smile of delight upon the face of the one who is enjoying this food with thankfulness in their heart to the Lord. That's what we get to enjoy. The donkey doesn't get to have the donkey eats until he's full, and then he lays down for a rest, and then he gets up and he eats again, and he goes through this instinctually guided cycle. But there's no rejoicing in his heart for his Creator. But that's what we get to have. The delight belongs to us. The gladness of heart, the strength of heart, the shining face, that's not given to the donkey, it's not given to the birds. That's given to us who are made in God's image. All right. So let me leave you with this then. When you think about feasting and the table and apply the proverb, of course, to any other provision that God gives in this life, consider and then use it properly. And guard yourself. Be aware of those situations and those temptation places where you may be especially tempted. Be aware of that and guard yourself. When God gives you these good things to enjoy, and let's think about the food, let's think about the delicacies on the table of the ruler. When God provides you nice things to enjoy, God is caring for you entirely, body and soul. That's one of the points of Psalm 104. There's an effect upon our souls, not just an effect upon our body. Your plate and your cup are opportunities for you to be renewed, not just physically. That's one of the points of Psalm 104. Your plate and your cup are opportunities for you to be renewed in gladness of heart. Your plate and cup are opportunities for you to be renewed in the cheerfulness of your countenance, in the strengthening of the inner person. But that's not because turkey is a means of grace. It's because you approach the plate of turkey or whatever it is you enjoy with a heart of thankfulness to the Creator who has so generously provided you things to enjoy. When we approach the table, the plate and the cup as the wise, when we look at what's in front of us with judgment, when we look at it with wisdom, when we judge it with discernment, that's when we can then take it in, not in an idolatrous way, not in a way where we're believing some lie that this is where my hope lies, but instead, I'm thankful for how the Lord has been so kind and generous to me, and oh, in the gospel, how generous and kind He has been to me. I eat and I drink with thankfulness in my heart to the one who has been kind to me at the table, but especially who has been kind to me in the forgiveness of my sins, in the provision of a Savior for me. That's how we enjoy these things with wisdom. Not putting them in the place of God, not making them our Savior. All right? The fear of the Lord is the beginning and the ongoing controlling principle for the wise perception, for the wise understanding, and for the wise use and management of things in our lives. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of sitting down at the table and not believing the lie. The fear of the Lord. So when you sit down to a table that's lavishly set, or before you is some other delightful provision of this life, what's the beginning of wisdom? What's the ongoing controlling principle of a discerning and wise use of that? It is your reverential, worshiping, believing, repenting, thankful submission to the God of covenant. That's where you begin. That's where you remain for the wise use of the good things that God gives us to enjoy.